This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Shout out to you and all of my friends who kept this secret for so long.
It was hard. It was hard. Hi, Tisha.
Hey, Donnie.
And welcome, friends, to Ursa Short Fiction, where we geek out on our favorite short stories and writers. I'm Donnie Walton, author of the final revival of Opal and Nev.
And I'm Disha Fulya, author of The Secret Lives of Church Ladies.
And today, we wanted to share a special bonus episode for our members and also celebrate a very special moment from my brilliant co-host, Disha Fulya. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to make a portion of this episode free for everybody because we want to shout our love for Disha from the rooftops. Brr, 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 brr. Then, if you'd like to access the rest of the episode where we answer listener questions, go become an Ursa member at ursastory.com/join. You'll get bonus episodes like this one, and I've got to say, there are a lot of great member bonus episodes from our past two seasons, specifically about the book publishing process, so go check those out. But now, let's say a huge congratulations to Disha Fulya, who has just signed a 7-figure deal for her next two books. So I want to read the opening paragraph of this Associated Press story, just so y'all know what a big deal this is. Okay, here we go. Prize-winning fiction writer Disha Fulya, who struggled to find a publisher for what became her acclaimed debut, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, has a 7-figure deal for her next two books. Mariner Books, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, announced Thursday that it had signed Fulya and will publish her novel, The True Confessions of First Lady Freeman, in 2025. Mariner calls the book a, quote, biting satire of the Black church and a, quote, deeply provocative story about family, friendship, and sexual agency. Fulya, who attended several different churches as a child, is centering the novel around a mega church leader. And as if that is not enough, we get a new collection too. New stories, Disha.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Okay. This is also from this story. Her second book from Mariner, Girl Look, is billed by the publisher as a, quote, poignant new collection, giving a vivid snapshot of the interior lives of Black women across generations, drawing readers to consider Black women and girls' vulnerabilities, invisibility, and beautiful contradictions in a post-COVID, post-Breonna Taylor world. Disha, are you floating right now? Like,
I am.
Can I live in your world for a minute? Like, okay. Like, tell me how you feel, first of all.
I made up this word called giddywhelmed. Like, I'm giddy and overwhelmed.
I love it.
So giddywhelmed. So giddywhelmed. Thank you well, for celebrating with me. I appreciate it.
As I have said to, so, I mean, listen, the network is buzzing, child. Like, everybody is like, oh my God, Disha. Like, everyone is so excited for you because a win for you feels like a win for all of us.
Yes. I'm glad you said that. And I am glad that people feel that because I think that I'm hoping that that's what it means for us. And that's why I wanted to be really transparent about it.
And I'm so glad that you are because, I mean, just that first clause in the story, you know, the fact that you had a hard time finding like one of the big five publishers, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And now, mm-hmm. like, I mean, it's like that Mike Jones song, right? We joked about that.
Mike Jones.
They all on you. They all on you.
That, well, I made a playlist to celebrate, and I think that was the first song Mike Jones, what is it called, Back Then?
Yeah.
Back Then, yes. Ooh. Mark, please put Back Then by Mike Jones in the show notes.
Oh my gosh. And this is so exhilarating to witness, Deisha, because I'm going to take us back. Like, okay. Let's see, when were we at Tin House? We were at Tin House in
early July.
Shout out to Tin House, by the way, which is probably the best teaching experience I've had and like a wonderful community. But Deisha and I were faculty, and we had workshop every day from 10 to noon. And at the time this was going on, Deisha was taking editor meetings, like first thing in the morning, right?
Yes.
Like, because we were in Portland on the West Coast and you were doing meetings on the East Coast. Yep. So like you were getting online at like what time?
Like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my gosh. I don't know how you could put a thought together.
Oh my gosh. It was such a wild time. Such a wild time.
And every day I would say, like, who do you like? How's it going? Like, you know, what are you hearing that sounds appealing? And I mean, I just kind of want to know about like how those meetings were for you and how you knew who really got your book and if there were any red flags or like what that whole process was like.
It really was a dream process because I didn't pick up any red flags, which was like blessing curse, right? So blessing that it was, you know, there was interest from multiple editors and houses who all had wonderful vision and understanding of both books. And I was really excited by their ideas from the editorial perspective, but also part of those calls were getting a chance to hear from their marketing and PR teams who were already developing like a vision around how these books could be promoted to readers. So I was excited by everything that I was hearing, which then means, okay, so now what? You know, it's easier if you're like, oh, I'm not really feeling, you know, this person and that person. But when they're is so much enthusiasm and care and thought that's being conveyed in these calls, you know, it was the proverbial good problem to have.
Right.
So each day, you know, even though I was up at the crack of dawn and, you know, then racing to workshop, I was exhilarated by it because, as you know, you do these work on these projects. Not completely in isolation, but for, you know, a good portion of it in isolation. And then you just don't know what's going to happen when other people start to read it. And then other people who have the power to, you know, to bring it to fruition and bring it out to readers, you know, that can be unnerving. And so to have those calls go so well, you know, I was just really buoyed by that.
And you know when they bring in the marketing teams, that's like serious.
Well, you know what's funny? I didn't know because I didn't have anything to compare it to. But I learned I was like, oh they're going to be other people on these. Well, I didn't even know about the calls. And then, you know, I found out about the calls because there was nothing like this with Church Ladies. In fact, West Virginia University Press was the only press that made an offer.
So in this hindsight, that is wild. That is just so wild in hindsight.
Yeah. So this, everything about this was new. So with the first couple of calls, you know, I didn't know what to expect. And then after a certain point, it kind of became routine because I had a few calls before I left for Tin House. It was between Vona, teaching at Vona and teaching at Tin House is when it started. And then I had the bulk of the calls during the 10 days that we were at Tin House. And then I had just a few more when I got back from Tin House. And then we were done. We started those calls just before Tin House. So that would have been, what, like early July. And then the auction was July 18th. So there was, you know, a little time in between in my agent schedule.
And you had a lot of meetings, right?
I did. I think it was like 15 or something like that for the US. And then the UK does it a little differently. Initially, I think it was something like 5 publishers that were interested in the UK. And they do calls after the bidding starts. And so when it came down to two publishers who were sort of neck and neck, then we had the calls. And they also, those calls were like 15 to 20 minutes long. I think the Brits don't like Zoom. And oh. Whereas like the US calls were like an hour long, but we still managed to cover the same amount of ground. I didn't feel like I had any unanswered questions or, you know, like it was just a very compact, concise call. With, again, the editors and the marketing publicity teams for those two publishers in the UK.
Wow. An auction.
Woo. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I kind of imagine what happens with that. Like, I'm thinking about, like, auctions. I've never been to one, but, like,
yes.
Watching auctions on TV
with the paddles
and the fast right. talking so and it's everything.
It's a little different.
Yeah, right.
And since we're talking business of publishing, I'll give a little primer on it. So what I learned, because again, all brand new, there are two types of bidding that can happen. And one is a best bids approach where it's, you know, it's like just go high or go home. Put your number down and then that's it. Then there's another approach, which is what my agent took, which is a round robin approach where the publishers bid and then for like a round one, here's everybody's bid. And then my agent calls everybody and tells them sort of where they landed in that process, right? Mm. So she would call whoever had the lowest bid first and tell them.
And be like,
them,
you better come up. You better.
Or, you know, they might drop out or whatever. And so we had many rounds of round robin. And then at a certain point, and again, this is one of the great things about agents. They know how this all works. There's a certain fatigue that can start to set in. And it's like, all right, now we go to best bids. And so she right. knew when to kind of pull that trigger. And so then it came down to best bids with the publishers that were still in play. So,
without getting into specifics, because I'm not trying to be in your bag, but I'm just saying, I was following this on text, right? And I feel like the bid started in the middle of the week or at the end of a week, and then they kept going up and up and up and up and up. And then it was the weekend, and it was like, oh, we got to come back on Monday.
It was so dramatic.
It was so dramatic.
And just shout out to you and all of my friends who kept this secret for so long.
It was hard. It was hard.
Because I couldn't not tell anyone. And so I was allowed to, but, you know, because it wasn't like a secret, because people in publishing knew what was happening. And so I was able to tell you and some other folks, and I really appreciate it being able to have those virtual screams about how it was going as it was happening. So it was like all this excitement. And then the deal was done end of July, but then publishing goes on hiatus for August. Right. Everybody's vacationing and they come back after Labor Day. And so you're like, well, yeah, we're going to wait to announce this until after Labor Day. So thank you for
my pleasure.
Celebrating with me when, you know, before the world knew. So it meant a lot.
And so I have also had the pleasure of getting a sneak peek of the novel, which had a different title when I read it. So first of all, what can you tell us about the true confessions of First Lady Freeman? And can you talk about like the process, like whatever changes that you've made already since it's been sold?
Since it's been sold. So, you know, my editor, Rekia Clark, the woman, the icon, the legend, Rekia Clark. She sent me her editorial letter in advance when the bidding was happening, but we've had our first official editorial call and she's, you know, giving me my lovely marching orders. And so I'll be revising the partial that's already written, but also finishing the novel so that I'll have a complete draft. And then she and I will be working to revise that. And so, you know, I feel like if I could sort of characterize Rekia's notes, I feel like she's helping me to be bolder, to be smarter, to be clearer about, you know, my main character, Charisse, and who she is and what she wants. She's helping me a lot with my pacing. You were asking about like how this came to fruition. I've been working on this novel since 2007, and then was also sort of dabbling in short stories. And that's where I pivoted to, in part because I was stalled on the novel. And so one of the things that I can see, and I think Rakia has pointed out, there's some pacing issues with the novel, because in some places there's a little drag, and then there are other places where it's so fast that I could like be a little more leisurely and spend a little time and go a little deeper. And I feel like I was bringing my short story pacing into some of this work. So it is such a different animal.
Yeah.
But when I started this book in 2007, the main character had a different name. She was always the wife of a megachurch pastor. That part has remained the same. And initially the title was Good Girl Anonymous, which I still think is a great title. And then it changed to Mrs. First Lady USA, which
that's the one I knew.
Yes, that is the title of the pageant that Char enters, which is a beauty pageant for megachurch pastors, middle-aged megachurch pastors' wives, very specifically. And then before we went out on submission, my agent was like, yeah, I don't love this title. And I never loved it either. It was more of a placeholder. It's very clunky. And so I asked a couple of friends for some suggestions. And my friend Patrice Grell Yersick said, what about The True Confessions of First Lady Friedman? And my agent and I, when I sent it to my agent, she screamed and she was like, this is it. And so it could still change by the time we get to publication. You know, things happen. But right now, we're loving that title.
And I feel like it's of a piece with The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. Mm-hmm. Secrets, confessions.
Yes.
Yes.
Dealing with the past.
Yes.
And it, you know, and initially, you know, 16 years is a long time. And so the character has changed a lot. I've changed a lot. The world has changed a lot. And so all of those factors have shaped the story and helped it to evolve. But the biggest change I would say is that I allowed Char, the main character, to actually be her own person. One of the reasons I realized in hindsight that I was stalled for so long with this book is that Char was me. Just sort of masqueraded as another character. And that was very limiting for her as a character and limiting for me as a writer, because she wasn't doing things that I wouldn't do. You know, her beliefs were my beliefs. Her moral code was mine. And that's not particularly interesting. But larger than a bigger problem with that, that my agent pointed out, and my agent is an editorial agent, so I have the benefit of her editorial insights. In a version of the story in, say, 2013, 2014, she pointed out that if Char's job is to be a first lady, to be a pastor's wife, and, you know, if you have a job that you hate, as Char did when this book, you know, in the early iteration of the book, if she hates the job and everything about it, and she's at best ambivalent about her marriage and all the things that go with it, if she risks losing that, because there's a scandal that breaks, that also has been the same throughout. There's a scandal. The scandal has changed, but a scandal breaks, and she risks losing everything. And my agent said, but if she doesn't care about everything, you know,
then there's not a lot to risk.
There's, right, and there are no stakes. Yeah. So I pieced that together. It took me maybe 6 more years to say, oh, okay, then she has to actually care about this life. She actually has to love being a first lady. I would not love being a first lady. And then it's like, but this isn't you, Deisha. This is Char. You know, so I'm having these internal conversations. So after Church Ladies came out, I went back to the novel with a new enthusiasm, also more confident as well. Mm-hmm. But I also had solved that piece of the puzzle, which is, oh, she's got to love everything about this. And then I have to cause problems for her with this scandal. And oh, by the way, that's a boring ass scandal. Let's give her a real scandal. So, you know, let's just keep ratcheting up the stakes for her, which is how many times have I taught a workshop called Raising the Stakes in Fiction? I needed to take my own advice.
Oh, but it's so many times that I don't take my own advice. Oh, and then right? It takes me months or sometimes a couple years to figure out the thing that I've been telling my students the whole time.
Exactly.
And on that point, I do think it's so important to, you know, say to writers that sometimes it can be dangerous to make your character so like yourself.
Yes.
Because it just, like you said, it's very limiting. Mm-hmm. You are kind of like cutting off possibilities for real juice, real drama, real intrigue or whatever it is that you're trying to do. So, but sometimes like it's very hard. Like if you have a strong point of view or a strong feeling towards something, it's hard not to mix yourself up in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's like building on ourselves, I think, you know, because, you know, Char still shares the same kind of background, you know, coming from a working class background, being the child of a single mother who was also a teenager. Her mother in the story is younger than my mother was, but still a teenager. And, you know, so there's some things that remain the same. But one of the things that happened when I allowed her to lean into the trappings of being a first lady is that she became like this fashionista and this brand whore, which required me to do a lot of research because I will shop at Target and love it. And so all of these brands and, you know, mid-level luxury or mid something luxury, like I had to immerse myself in that world. And, you know, and something else that I learned as a writer that, you know, where people will say it, but until you experience it, you maybe have some doubts. Like there is the magic that can happen where you follow one thing and then it opens up a whole other world of narrative possibility, plot, like everything. And so just by allowing Char to love fashion, from that, you know, many dots connected later, introduced another character that I hadn't envisioned, introduced a few dynamics and plot stories, introduced some imagery and symbolism that I had not planned, but all came from just allowing her to really be into labels and, you know, who made what and who's wearing what. And that's how she, when she enters a room, she immediately assesses people based on what they're wearing. And then that's something that seems sort of light and frivolous turned into a very rich well that I could draw from as the story developed.
Wonderful. And I just, like, I have to say, this book is funny. It is thoughtful. I mean, I still have to read the other half because you know, I just read the first half and you sold on a partial, but I'm so excited to like see what happens with the rest of this novel.
Thank you.